When my parents passed away in the mid-1970s, I found a mommy and daddy letter dated the 30th of March, 1938, in which I begged for my upcoming 11th birthday a copy of Lost on the Moon. And this is a letter I wrote them. I didn't, more than verbal. And I also made a note that they had given me a Roy Rockwood books the previous birthday. I think it was Bob Mars, and My Spaceship to Mars, and one of those books. These are boys' books. And I just adored them. And then I got hooked on the pulp magazine world. And I started collecting. I just put a list of some of the amazing stories, science, one of the stories, Astounding Science Fiction, Dynamic Science Stories, Astonishing Stories, Comet Stories, Marvel Science Stories, Planet Stories, Scott Starling Stories, on and on. I collected a huge, eventually, collections of about 1,000 pulp magazines, with unbroken collections. And I joined fan clubs, science fiction fan clubs. I was still a kid. And we would trade. Some guy would have an extra copy of the Planet Stories, you know, for a certain date. I didn't have it, but I had an extra Starling story. And then I began to get into the technical books because I wanted to read more about technical books. And I found out very quickly through the science fiction that you needed only way to get to other worlds was with a rocket. So I joined as a student member of the American Rock Society when I was 13 years old. And I've been a member of it and its follow-on name, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, ever since. So I've been a member of it. Paid my dues every year for 72 years. With this background, I have just got to tell you how excited I was when I met Arthur Clarke, who was an early hero of mine through fiction and nonfiction alone. We ran into each other in Paris on the 29th of September, 1950, which is 63 and a few weeks ago. 63 years in a few weeks. And I discovered at that same time we met at the first International Astronautical Congress. And I immediately registered as for the American Rock Society, and I was the only American president. It was mostly a European event, but to get things started at least. And they had a second meeting in London the next year to set up the bylaws and the constitution and so forth. And then in the third year it was in Stuttgart, where they formally initiated the International Astronomical Federation. And I've been a congressgoer literally ever since. And we just got along almost immediately. I told him about my interest in science fiction and science fiction. He was a little kid and he had the same background. And he immediately ushered me into the British Interplanetary Society, whose tie I'm wearing tonight for the 60th anniversary. Thought that'd be appropriate for Arthur. And he gave me, made me a member, and then 5 months later he elevated me, just a young, still just starting my career, to a fellow. And then he gave me a copy of Interplanetary Flight, which was published by Temple Press in 1950. It was a scientific book, lots of equations in it. And then that was followed the next year by Exploration of Space, which is a popular book. It just did very well in England and in the United States. And with my new wife, Maria Victoria, we used the nickname Malula, we began to socialize over there in Europe, because I was over there for 2 years doing some graduate studies at the Faculty of Sciences in upper atmosphere physics and also in a lot of the geophysical area that I was originally in. And we got good things together. I met his wife, Marilyn, but it didn't last long, unfortunately, with Rutherford. That was a very short-lived marriage. And we knew his brother Fred, we met Angie and other members of the family. And we became quite close over those 2 years. And then when Arthur moved to Ceylon, we saw each other less frequently, but we kept in touch, and he did a lot of things for me. He wrote an introduction in one of my books, and then afterward for another book. And so we did things back and forth. And then I got to talk to you about January 1965. To really have a huge event with my life. I was in New York attending a week-long professional meeting of the American Rock Society and also meeting with my three of my publishers, Academic Press, on that occasion, D.E.B. Dutton, and Prentice Hall. I had various books going with each of them. And Somebody said along the day, oh, by the way, I've heard your friend Arthur Clarkson's now. And I didn't know that because we didn't necessarily keep each other informed about our individual travels. And I knew he always stayed at the Chelsea Hotel at 23rd Street, so I rang him up and he answered the phone. And I said, this is Fred Ortberg. Oh, my God, Fred, how are you? And I'm here in Washington, I'm in New York. And we immediately got together and we decided to meet at the Harvard Club. When I'm in town, I stay at the Harvard Club. And we had met there many times before. And so we had a lovely evening, and we started at 5 o'clock. And he told me about why he was there. He was there to publicize a recently published book by Time Right, and I've been approached by a man named Stanley Kubrick, the director, who approached him to see if his interest would be to do a film based on, I have an artifact here I've got to show you. This Pulp magazine story came out in spring of 1951 in 10 Stories Fantasy Magazine, which didn't last at all. Not in any of the regular magazines you expect to be wrote in here. And a fascinating tale. And this is the only Pulp magazine in my collection that I didn't get to Harvard, because I figured I might need this for some occasion. And I'm going to read to you two excerpts to this movie. When they discovered the monument of the sentinel on the moon, I was standing on a plateau, perhaps 100 feet across. It had once been smooth, too smooth to be natural, but falling meteors had pitted and scored its surface through immeasurable eons, and had been leveled to support a glittering, roughly pyramidal structure twice the size of man that was set in the rock like a gigantic, multifaceted jewel. Towards the end of the other excerpt, I want to see the romanticism of Arthur Clarke, that was set there, he knew, by super civilization, not by, at first he thought it might have been ancient Egypt. Egyptians somehow got to the moon, but he discarded that in his story. And he knew that there were interstellar wanderers. And he said, these wanderers must have looked on Earth, circling safely in the narrow zone between fire and ice, and must have guessed that it was the favorite of the sun's children. Here, in the distant future, would be intelligence. But there were countries, countless stars before them still, and they might never come this way again. So they left a sentinel, one of millions they had scattered throughout the universe, watching over all worlds with the promise of life. It was a beacon that down to the ages has been patiently signaling that fact, that no one had yet discovered it. And of course, they did discover it. And he said at the end, he said, I never can look out the Milky Way without wondering from which of these banked clouds of stars the emissaries are coming. If you will pardon some commonplace simile, we have broken the glass of the fire alarm and have nothing to do but to wait, and I don't think we'll have to wait for long. It was that story that captivated the interest of Stanley Kubrick. It was possible, well modified in the book. And it turned out that my two books had just published a book by D.P. Dunn called Intelligence in the Universe, and I was doing another book it's still in the galley stage, for Prentice Hall, and it seemed that it turned out that Arthur and Stanley and I were working along parallel paths. Anyway, as we continued to talk, I reviewed my activities working for Burnham and Brown in Huntsville, Alabama. And we talked about his forthcoming work with Kubrick and so forth. And we all looked at our watches, and we both had evening dinner events high up in Park Avenue. And so we said goodbye, and he left. And I went upstairs. It was a cold evening. It was snowing. This was in January of 1965. And to get my overcoat, and then I was downstairs hailing a cab at the front door mat to go up to my Park Avenue evening affair. When the employees came up to me and said, you have a telephone call coming in on the downstairs club phone. I picked up the phone, and a voice said, my name is Stanley Cooper. It's all for a moment, sorry. And I said, you're like, yes, sir, but you know. And he explained that Arthur Clark had just called him and was urgently felt that we should meet. So Arthur Clark, Fred Orway, Stanley Kubrick went ahead and we had a meeting on the 23rd of January, 1965, in Kubrick's apartment on Midtown in Manhattan, where he lived. And the outcome of that was that I was asked to become the technical advisor to the film. So the idea was for Arthur Clarke to write a novel, a draft novel, always keeping in mind that it would eventually be, it would want to have a film version of it. So it was a man writing a novel with a film version in the back of his mind at all times. He would also be the co-author of the film part of, it, of the story, the film story. And I guess you would say from the, it would be the screenplay that would be the thing that you'd write. And anyway, you'd be co-author of the screenplay. You'd get that credit. So Kubrick, myself as director, co-author of the screenplay was Kubrick and Arthur Clarke. Then Arthur Clarke would be author, not with Kubrick, but the author of the resulting novel. But in this case, which is very unusual, it would not be published until after the film had its premiere, which is for usually the film is based on a book published and so forth. And unusual, but it worked out very well. And so I've got to tell you then some of the final parts of all of this. The rest is history. We set up our small office in the Polaris Productions of Stanley Kubrick, the three of us. I guess you have a picture of the three of us up there. Various people came in from England to help us. We had a small group of some designers, and Judy Meehoff was our secretary, that sort of ran the office. Tony Masters was the art director, and John Hosley was his assistant. Harry Lager came up from Huntsville to work with me. And so we had a group, a small group, maybe it might have been 10, working at Polaris Productions. So we got started with the three of us. Except for Judy, we were alone when we this all started. And except, of course, Arthur had been working on the screenplay, the novel, not the screenplay yet. And so there we were, and then I've got to go forward now to the 2nd of April, 1968. We started in January 1965, so we're 68. Title had meanwhile become 2001 Space Odyssey, and I may explain that if you had a question about it. It premiered in Washington, the Uptown Theater, near here, everybody knows on Connecticut Avenue. And I want to quote, the Hollywood Reporter headlined the next day, one of MGM's all-time hits, majestic visual experience, tantalizing and nameless, provide challenge to unknown barriers. That's the Hollywood Reporter. Now we're going to go fast forward 44 years to 1 August 2012, just a year ago. The Hollywood Reporter was telling the world that the British Film Institute had just revealed the results of a once-in-a-decade international film poll. And they interviewed 842 anybody that was interested, reporters, academics, authors, and so forth. They had a real strong interest in film, and could back them up with some real experience, but they did not work in the industry. And 2001, the History of Films came in number 6, which is very impressive for a brand new film. But this is the one I want to give you stress. In a separate poll of 358 film directors worldwide, these are directors from films from all over the world, it came in number 2 in the history of filmmaking. The Tokyo Story by Ozu came in number 1, and Citizen Kane, came in 3rd. Number 2 in the world, Mike said. Sadly, by then, both Stanley and the author had left us, respectively, in 1999 and 2008. How proud they would have been as we are tonight with the magnificent achievement and the international acclaim it achieved. But now, that didn't end my association with the film. I've been stuck with it, oh, that's maybe a bad word, ever since. I've been lecturing at every major anniversary all over the country in history, overseas. I travel a great deal overseas, and they, sometimes the State Department may ask me to add on something about 2001. And it was, when we had the 25th one, were you there? The place was packed. Remember, the main theater was filled, and there was an equal number of people waiting for the second showing. Frank Winter came to me and told me, "Fred, the film is not here." And I said, "My God, where's the back door?" And he said, "No, it's at the bus station. We had a limited budget to do these things, and MGM charges so much every day. And what was there, you guys would fetch the car and pick it up." And he told me, "When you go in there, I usually give a half an hour talk before to explain what's going on and so forth." And he said, "When you see the little red button blinking up there in the projection booth, that means we have it." And so everything turned out beautifully that 25th anniversary. And I did these things all over the country. And I'll just mention one more. The real year 2001 at the University of Illinois Urbana, where HAL was born, Heuristic Algorithm Design, not IBM. Oh, everybody thought Heuristic Algorithm, H-A-L. You guys must have been giving backhand credit to IBM, which is our main consultant on the film. But that hadn't occurred to us. But I want to assure you, it was a HAL algorithmic computer design picture. So we had a big program at the university, Kierdelay came, and offered Kierdelay with company for lectures around the country. He was the only one that seemed to take a big interest of it. And coincidentally, they're showing how frequent things are. Just the 21st of September, I was giving a major lecture on the film to the Explorers Club. And at Huntsville, I gave a lecture, that was here in Washington, and then I gave a lecture, coincidentally, on the same film, to the Alliteration Alone in Huntsville, Alabama. So it never ends. And clearly, I'll be tied to Arthur C. Clarke in 2001 for the rest of my life, and I have no regrets over it. So I want to give you many, many thanks for this wonderful award, and I deeply, deeply appreciate it. Thank you so very much. First of all, I enjoyed the whole film. I had nothing to do with the final part, all with the young daughter man, other than bring in to, as one of our consultants, Richard Leakey from the Leakey family. We had Lewis, I knew Lewis Leakey, and Richard was the consultant. But my job in the film part was just the technical part, from the beginning, the first space flight from Earth to the arrival of Jupiter. All the rest was but pure fantasy, but done by special effects. Very, very interesting. I know the idea behind it was that you'd meet a super civilization, and they would want to have an emissary from planet Earth, and to open up planet Earth to form part of the galactic system, let's say, of intelligent species, and they, then became a child again as he orbited around the Earth. He would be sent back to Earth and he would grow up, but his mind would be, as he grew up, would be so engaged as to receive the first emissaries from the super civilization. It was pure fantasy, but fascinating.
I really helped, thanks.
Did I help any?
Well, I have a technical question. Is it true that the first model, the first idea for the Discovery would be there was an Orion type spaceship?
The shape we worked on, first of all, let me tell you what my job was. We're working in New York for about 6 months. And I grew up in this field, but I didn't know a hell of a lot of things about what it might be like, 35 years in the future. And so I went to all my colleagues that I had and the NASA stations and the academics and industry and so forth. And it's all in this book that they're selling out here, 2001, The Lost Science. And I went to General Electric in that particular case. They had this Cavendish system they were working on, gas and nuclear core the propulsion, and they gave me all the designs of the future project, what it might look like in the future, in that particular case. And we accepted that as a propulsion system. Now, in all these cases, for everything you saw there, every panel, every button, every visual display, Cooper insisted that it be realistic because he didn't know where he was going to focus the camera. So when I went out, for example, the Schlumberger, we had a geophysical module on the ship. But this is the kind of presentation I shouldn't make with visual, but that would take too long. And so everything in there, it wasn't necessarily what I would know, but that we had them do it. They were a geophysical survey company. In the hibernation, we hibernated three astronauts. They were not named in the film, but we nicknamed them Hunter, Kaminsky, and Whitehead. So anyway, that's a little thing, but that's what we call the nicknames of them. So I had to deal in California, here in California, but mainly in New York, fortunately, for us, because I was working there, with Dr. Owen Mitchell. And he was an expert in hibernation at the New York University School of Medicine. And he invited me over to his office. He opened his fridge one time and showed me all these little animals that were normally hibernated, but he put them in hibernation out of season. He knew how to do that. He could put hibernators in hibernation whenever he wanted. And he could put species close to them that were not normal hibernators, but he could put them in hibernation. And I asked him, NASA had a multi-million dollar contract for you, we're going to send a real ship to Jupiter, could you do it? He said, probably so, it would be very exhausting. But I said, well, if you did it, then could you give me the technical, what would the display say? What physical elements would you be monitoring all the way out to Jupiter? And they did that. And so that was how I dealt with all these companies. I went to RCA. for helping the Whirlpool company in Benton Harbor for the kitchens. You see that, how we did that, all right. This is a visual, going all that shit out of business, with me. And we set up of the Tycho magnetic anomaly, for example, with the central, we visually call the platform, the monument. And all the instrumentation around that was all done by RCA. For example, and they were all totally realistic. What their projection 35 years in the future, what that instrumentation might be to analyze is very strange. After so in all these elements, I would go to the companies. I went to the Royal Astronomical Observatory, for example, in Greenwich, for the panel for astronomical investigation. So the panel you see there is all very, very active by the experts. And that's how I handle this.
Well, thank you.
Quite well. Okay.
Thank you very much.